Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Mitch Teich. Next week, we'll get an update on Wisconsin's efforts to cope with the emerald ash borer, an insect which threatens to kill millions of ash trees in Wisconsin and other states in the Midwest and eastern United States. The invasive species is one of only many biological and policy issues currently facing forests, and it's only the latest chapter in a complex history that's led to the creation of the National Forest System. Writer Christopher Johnson details much of that history and the issues surrounding national forests in a new book called Forests for the People, The Story of America's Eastern National Forests. He's with us in the studio now. Welcome to the show.
I'm glad to be here. Thank you very much for inviting me, Mitch.
What makes eastern national forests distinct from the system of national forests at large? What are the issues that are specific to them versus national forests in the Southwest or in Alaska or across the system?
The big difference is water. In the eastern national forests, which we generally think there are a few in Minnesota that are west of the Mississippi, but really the primary dividing point is the Mississippi River. And so when we talk about the eastern national forests, we're talking about two regions of the Forest Service. One is for the Midwest, centered in Milwaukee, and the other is for the southern forest, and they are in Atlanta, Georgia. And so what distinguishes them is that there is plenty of water. When you go out west to the national forests of Arizona or New Mexico, there is much less water. It's a much more arid environment. And as a result of that, the eastern forests followed very different paths. But there are also other differences having to do with how this country was settled and cultural differences and so forth.
Well, let's talk about some of that early history and about what the first attitudes towards forests were, which I gather were fairly similar in the Northeast and in the Lake States.
They absolutely were. The heavy logging really started during the colonial era in New England, and it continued. And then when the Industrial Revolution really took off in the 1840s, 1850s with the Civil War, then you saw very heavy logging in New England, and what a process that we call clear cutting, where the loggers would go in and they would just cut all the trees, regardless of their maturity or their size, an entire tract. And in the late 1800s, this was having a devastating impact on New England's forests. And so you started to see a forest conservation movement build up around that, particularly because these areas had become very popular for tourism.
Well, and when you talk about the heavy impact they had, this is not just on the scenic beauty. I mean, not just the fact that there were large pieces of forest that were suddenly gone, but there were some real natural kinds of other impacts that happened down the road from them.
There certainly were. What you found were huge forest fires. When the logging companies would go in and do the heavy logging, they would leave a lot of the limbs and the canopies, the trees on the ground, and these would dry up, and they basically became kindling. So in the late 1800s and early 1900s, you had huge forest fires. And this had a huge impact on the economic development in Maine and New Hampshire and Vermont, because people they wanted to go see beautiful forests, and it was really interrupting the tourism. But it was also really having an impact on the rivers and streams. What happened was that as the forest disappeared, water would run into, during storms, would run into the streams and rivers, and you had enormous flooding. And this had huge economic impact on Manchester and other cities along the rivers in New England. You also had silt. They were experiencing silt and buildup of the rivers and streams. And this actually became a key element in passing legislation that helped to restore those forests in the eastern United States. And then what you found was that the loggers had really clear-cut a lot of the forest land in New England, and so they looked to the Lake States and they did the same thing. Michigan had huge forests of beautiful white pines, and at that time, Chicago and Detroit and the other Midwestern cities were growing rapidly. So there was a huge demand for these trees, and white pine just made great lumber. So again, logging industry came in and clear cut the white pines in Michigan and northern Wisconsin, and then they moved to Minnesota. So you had the same experience where these forests were really devastated and there was no movement to restore them or to keep the forests logged on a sustainable basis.
Well, and I gather that's what really ended up driving the conservation movement in the Lake States was a desire to manage them sustainably so there would be a future supply of timber for use in building materials.
That's right. In all three Midwestern states, after the loggers came, economic devastation followed in these small towns in northern Michigan and northern Wisconsin. And the state legislatures were really, in the early 1900s, were trying to figure out ways to make these areas, these counties, productive again. They even encouraged farming in the northern counties. And that didn't work so well because there were like hundreds of stumps that had to be removed. The soil was not any good for farming. And as anybody who vacations up there knows, the climate is not really conducive to farming.
The growing season is about 3 weeks long.
It's about 3 weeks long. That's right. And so it was kind of a boondoggle. But there are reports in the early 1900s of researchers would go into these towns where farmers were desperately trying to farm these cutover lands. And it just was not working. And it added to really a depression type of environment. And the tourism had not developed to the point yet in the early 1900s that could provide, you know, bring money into the northern counties of all three states.
When did the wilderness movement come into the equation?
That really started after World War II. 1911 saw the passage of the Weeks Act, which allowed the federal government to buy these cutover lands and restore them. And that happened in the East and in the South and in the Midwest. And so the Forest Service led the way in an incredible restoration of these forests.
How did they do it?
How did they do it? They went and planted. During the Civilian Conservation Corps planted millions of trees, you know, and little they would grow seedlings in nurseries and then they would take them out to the forest and they would plant them. And one of the interesting things is the United States, the foresters tried to replicate the look of the forest. They had learned a lot of these forestry techniques from Germany and France. Well, when you went to restored forests in Germany, they were all planted in rows. You know, kind of a, you know, and
as you very would expect,
orderly,
the
you might expect very orderly approach. So, and early foresters like Aldo Leopold, who would later become one of the founding fathers of the ecology movement, went there, just were appalled at this. And so they encouraged and trained foresters to try to replicate the look of forests as they did replanting. And also, as I mentioned, there was plenty of water. So these forests did naturally regenerate. Seeds would flow, you know, the breeze would blow. Birds would bring them in. There were just many ways in which and because of the ample rainfall, these forests did regenerate themselves. But what was key was putting in techniques for sustainable forestry. The national forests are used to provide lumber to us, but they do so on a sustainable basis. And so there was a major effort in order to learn and teach these techniques of forestry. What happened with the wilderness movement is that in the economic boom of the 50s and early 60s, then the Forest Service started allowing clear cutting again. And there were two major incidents that happened in the early 60s, one on the Monongahela National Forest in West Virginia, the other on the Bitterroot National Forest in Montana, where areas that tourists and hunters and fishermen liked were clear cut. This led to just a huge outcry and accusations that the Forest Service was not managing the forests for all uses. You know, that's the philosophy, multiple uses, which includes recreational use, hunting, fishing, as well as hiking and camping. So there was a feeling that the forests, so that some of the national forests need to be preserved as wilderness. And so that really gave an impetus to the passage of the Wilderness Act in 1964, through which parts of many national forests were set aside, no vehicles of any kind, no logging, no mining, no drilling for oil or natural gas. They were really managed. They were really allowed to develop as wilderness. And so they became a very important part of the ecology of national forests, as well as popular among recreational people who wanted to go into them and to be able to hike in areas that really felt pristine. And the word pristine is used in the Wilderness Act. These areas are to be kept pristine.
Well, and you write – you make an interesting point in this book. You know, we tend to think of wilderness and preservation and economic development as an either-or sort of equation. But you write about particularly the areas in the Monongahela and the Boundary Waters Canoe Area Wilderness as examples that economic development is not necessarily distinct from wilderness preservation.
That is a really important point. And when I was reporting the Monongahela National Forest, there was a push among people who wanted more wilderness in West Virginia in the 1980s and 1990s. And one of their major arguments was that West Virginia has beautiful forests, that this was an untapped resource for recreation. So I went out there twice to talk to people, to observe, to hike through the forest myself. And I just found that there's a whole infrastructure that has built around recreation in West Virginia. And a lot of small businesses have participated in the campaign to get more wilderness because that is what draws people. West Virginia is in the east, and there are not that many pristine wooded areas left in the east, particularly that are hilly, that are good for climbing. And so there's just a lot of advantages to preventing these areas from being devastated by coal mining or heavy logging and that sort of activity.
Well, let's flash forward to the 21st century. You write about the encroachment of the emerald ash borer, specifically in Michigan's national forest, but obviously it's an issue facing forests in Wisconsin and really throughout the East now. Would you say, is that situation with that particular invasive emblematic of a larger issue facing forests in the 21st century?
It's one of the big threats. What's happened is that with globalization, insects and diseases can more easily travel around the world. And the emerald ash borer was something that we decided to write about because it really is that has had a huge effect on the Midwestern forest. It makes a good case study for invasive species because it was an insect that is found in China. And it doesn't harm the ash trees in China, which have evolved to resist the insect. However, the ash trees here did not have those natural defenses against the insect. And so it was able to spread and to infect ash trees. And really, the biologists so far have not found ways to defeat this insect. And it's just one of many, many insects and diseases that are really threatening forests around the world. And it's a huge matter of concern that botanists, biologists are working to try to solve.
You also pose the question of whether there are some forests that are at the risk of being loved to death, which is a term that's also been applied to some national parks. What are you getting at when you write that?
Well, I co-wrote this book with a forester from New Hampshire named David Gavaxi. David told me that after parts of the White Mountains, which is where he lives, were, you know, approved as wilderness. You know, to create wilderness takes a an act of Congress. And after this was done, all of a sudden these wilderness areas were more popular than they had been before. There's just something about that word wilderness that attracts people. This is a big reason why people visit national forests. There are certain national forests that are really in the danger of being overrun. And not only are they overused, you do find in the White Mountains in certain areas that there is some limitation on the number of passes and number of primitive camping permits that are granted for that reason. But another danger is just the whole attraction of living near these pristine and beautiful areas. We write in the book about Vermont and North Carolina, where these exurban areas where people are buying homes that back right up to the national forests. And that presents a big problem, because it creates air pollution, water pollution. You get more sidewalks. You get more driveways, which increases flooding in the accompanying rivers and streams. It also reduces the habitat connectivity, and that has an effect on wildlife. So in Vermont, there have been problems with bears and other animals that hibernate, other animals that migrate from north to south, and they have fewer paths for migration than they did because of the overdevelopment. So this idea of overdevelopment is really having an impact on the national forest.
You mentioned your co-author is a former forester. What about you? Where does your own interest in this subject come from?
Well, we lived for many years in Boston, and we had grown up in the Midwest, so I wasn't that familiar really with forest and mountainous areas. But as we raised our children, we would go hiking and camping and do the things that you do, particularly in Vermont and New Hampshire. And I started reading about the region, and I started reading some of the history of the region. And the history of those states is just so intertwined with logging, with railroads. I found that fascinating and started researching it and writing about it would write about magazines. In 2006, I wrote a book about the White Mountains called This Grand and Magnificent Place, which is about the hotels and the forests and how they were threatened. It was about the passage also of the Weeks Act and the development of wilderness. It was what I discovered in researching that book and that David and I carried into this book is that there – when we talk about the forests of the United States, first of all, they're an extraordinary accomplishment, that restoring these forests. And I think the country should be proud that we have done such a good job with these restoring and managing these forests. But that when we talk about protecting them, first of all, they are a fragile environment. They can easily go away. And that when you talk about them, there's so many factors that come together. There certainly is ecology, the ecosystem of the forest, which we know so much more about than we did, but also their economic, their social, their cultural forces at work in protecting and respecting and managing the forest. And I think that has been my biggest takeaway in doing the research over the years about these forests is that they're really systems that require us to look globally, to think holistically about them. You can't separate one aspect, like the ecosystems, from economic development and from the culture. The culture is so important, you know, so intertwined with the forest, the lore, the stories that people tell, which are just wonderful, have to do with the stories. And it has to do also with the value that local residents place on these forests and the way that their lives are really intertwined and their family histories are intertwined with these forests. And that was just one of the most fascinating things to me, the poetry and the stories that people told about these forests.
In a way, you're seeing the forest for more than the trees.
That's exactly right, yes.
Chris Johnson, thank you so much.
Thank you very much for having me, Mitch.
Chris Johnson is the co-author, along with David Gavatsky, of the new book Forests for the People, the story of America's Eastern National Forests, published by Island Press. Johnson lives in Evanston, Illinois, and you'll find a link to more information from wuwm.com/lakeeffect. A majority of the people who live in Milwaukee are from this state. What economic difference does that make? A Lake Effect essayist has some thoughts when we return on Milwaukee Public Radio.